Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are wrestling with, well, one of the biggest questions out there, really.
Absolutely, the idea of truth, or vérité, as our source puts it.
Yeah, and it's called a necessary enigma, which I think is perfect. It's this puzzle we keep coming back to because, honestly, no answer has ever felt completely right.
Exactly, and our source material points out that this persistence is kind of the point. Yeah. Philosophy itself, its whole reason for being, hinges on this core problem.
Which is?
How do we actually tell the difference between what is true and what I just think is true? Or, you know, what my group, my society holds to be true. Opinion, basically.
Right. And the text suggests if philosophers ever just gave up on that question, said, okay, we can't figure it out,
then philosophy would just sort of collapse. It wouldn't be philosophy anymore. Maybe just like history of ideas or just playing with words.
The struggle is the point. It keeps it alive.
Mm-hmm. But what's really shifted, and this is where it gets urgent, is that this question isn't just for philosophers in quiet rooms anymore.
No, it's exploded. It's front and center in, well, pretty much every social debate in the 21st century.
It really has. And a huge catalyst for that is the digital age.
Okay, explain that. Because historically, we always kind of knew words could trick you, right? Propaganda, rumors.
Yeah.
You're always a bit skeptical.
Sure. We developed ways to deal with deceptive language over centuries. But images, photos, film, they seem different.
They felt real, like evidence, the camera doesn't lie, or so we thought. They seem to have these marks of veracity.
Exactly. That direct link to reality. But digital technology, it just shatters that. Deep fakes, perfect Photoshop, AI-generated voices, whole scenes.
And they spread instantly everywhere. And the terrifying thing is you often literally cannot tell them apart from a real recording.
Mm-hmm. Visually,
yeah.
Audibly,
yeah.
Indistinguishable. So that old trust we placed in images, gone.
So visual proof is now in the same tricky category as words, but maybe even more dangerous because we're not as used to doubting it.
Precisely. And this isn't just an abstract problem anymore. It hits critical areas. Think about it.
Democracy, for sure. If you can sway public opinion with fake videos.
Or if people just get used to believing whatever some algorithm feeds them because it matches what they already searched for. That's a crisis of shared reality.
So, okay, the basic philosophical question isn't new, but the scale, the speed, the impact, that's unprecedented.
Right. We still haven't solved the enigma, but we absolutely cannot ignore the consequences now. So that's our mission today.
We're diving deep into these sources to really get our heads around the philosophical differences, opinion, truth, and this really potent modern idea, the counter-truth, or contra-verité.
And we want you listening to understand why this stuff matters. It's not just theory. It connects directly to your everyday choices, how you think, and honestly, your well-being.
Okay, so let's really dig into this relationship. Our beliefs, our opinions, the things we're sure are right versus philosophical truth.
We all run on opinions, right?
No.
It's natural. We find explanations that seem solid, descriptions that feel faithful, and we hold them as true.
And if something lines up with our research, our analysis, we accept it. If it doesn't, we reject it. That's just being rational.
It is. But philosophers, for literally thousands of years, keep hammering this point.
Yeah.
What I hold to be true, my opinion, even if it's incredibly well justified, proven, verified, gavres, as the source says.
It's still fundamentally different from what is true.
Yes. And this is where the source brings in a really high-stakes ethical concept. We need to unpack this carefully.
This is the dimension personnel. The personal dimension. It sounds psychological, like my inner thoughts or feelings.
But the source is very clear.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's not your subjective inner world.
Okay, so what is it then?
It's defined as the process of valorizing persons and their world, giving them ethical weight, essentially.
How does that happen?
Through action.
Mm-hmm.
Through your presence in the world. It emerges from the way you navigate the different roles, the different scenes and characters you embody throughout your life.
So it's like your ethical development, mm-hmm. Your value isn't fixed. It grows or shrinks based on how you engage with the world.
You got it. It's dynamic. It's about ethical growth through lived experience. And this is the key difference between truth and opinion.
How so?
The source claims that a true formulation, encountering a philosophical truth, actually adds to this dimension personnel. It contributes positively. It expands you, valorizes you and your world, and ultimately leads towards happiness.
Okay. But what about opinion then? Say I spend years mastering quantum physics. I verify the theories. I hold them as true. Surely that adds to my personal dimension.
According to this framework?
Yeah.
An opinion, what is merely held to be true, even if it's perfectly justified like your physics example,
mm-hmm.
It's considered ethically Without effect.
Without effect, that's bold.
Think of your strongest, most justified opinion like a house you've built. It's solid, weatherproof, based on sound engineering. You live in it comfortably.
Okay.
But philosophically, it doesn't help you grow ethically. It just keeps you secure within those walls. Static. Inert.
Wow. So just having knowledge, even proven knowledge, isn't enough for personal ethical development if I just accept it, if I treat it like a finished product.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It only becomes philosophy, it only starts that valorization process when you actively challenge it, when you put it at risk.
So the philosophical effort is really about fighting the comfort of certainty, the comfort of your own opinion.
Precisely. The moment you settle, the moment you say, this is it, proven, done, the ethical growth, the valorization, stops. Philosophy critiques common sense, sure, but its real engine is using that tension truth versus opinion to figure out what helps us grow versus what makes us regress ethically.
This leads directly to that personal anecdote in the source, which I found fascinating, about the struggle against self-confirmation.
Yeah, it's a great example of how hard this actually is in practice. The author holds this really core belief. Music is the language of the living. Mathematics is the language of the world.
And they describe it as luminous and clarifying. Ah. It organizes everything for them.
Right. For most of us, that would be it. Foundational belief. Build everything else on top of it.
But to do philosophy,
you have to fight it, especially your strongest, most cherished opinion. So the author deliberately sought out philosophers with radically different views.
Like Wittgenstein, who had a totally different take on language and logic, completely at odds with the math is the language of the world idea, seeking the foreign procedure.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easy. The author admits they learned much less, quote unquote, from reading Wittgenstein than if they just stuck to research that confirmed their existing views.
It's easier to learn when things just click, right?
Of course. But that deliberate difficulty, that turn towards the opposition, that is the prerequisite for real philosophical work, according to this view.
So wait a minute. Truth isn't something you find out there, like digging up treasure.
It's more like something you invent, or maybe construct.
Ow!
By turning away from the comfort of your opinion, you're held to be true, you're forced into this act of invention. You have to create a new formulation, a new way of seeing things.
And that invention is what valorizes the personal dimension, because it forces you to expand ethically.
Exactly. But here's the catch. Even that new invention can't become the final resting place. You have to eventually put that at a distance, too, to keep the process going.
Wow. So it's a perpetual motion machine of challenging yourself. The goal isn't the answer. It's the ongoing engagement with what's difficult and different. That's the only path to ethical growth.
That seems to be the core argument. The opinion is just a starting point, maybe even a necessary one, but never the destination. Okay, so if opinion is, let's say, neutral ground, ethically inert, and truth is this active, difficult process of growth and valorization,
then we need to talk about the real danger, the active destructive force, the counter-truth, the contra-verite.
Yes. This is where it gets really serious, ethically and socially. Because this isn't just about being wrong, it's about something else entirely.
The archer analogy the source uses is just brilliant here. It really clarifies the difference.
It does. So picture knowledge-seeking as archery practice. Spectators are watching.
What do they expect?
Well, usually two things. Either the archer misses the target, that's an error, a simple mistake, predictable, even common.
Or, much harder, the archer hits the bullseye. That's truth. It takes skill, effort, focus, and you need a whole process to verify, yep, that really hit the center.
Right. Verification is crucial for truth. But the counter-truth...
The archer turns around and shoots the spectators.
Exactly. The original target doesn't matter anymore. The rules of hitting the target, the whole true-false distinction, the need for verification, they're completely ignored.
And it hits people directly. No verification needed. In fact, verification is often impossible by design. It just grabs you.
And that's its power. We often think truth is the strongest force, but we're usually just comparing it to simple error.
But history shows
that statements that completely ignore the true-false axis are often way more powerful. Think demagogues, propaganda, even some powerful myths. They seize minds instantly, shape how people think, get mass buy-in.
Because they're not playing the verification game. They operate by flipping values, changing the benchmarks entirely.
And that brings us back to the core ethical difference. Truth increases valorization, remember. Builds up the personal dimension.
But the counter-truth actively reduces it. It's a force of devalorization. It degrades ethical value.
They both transform values, yes, but in completely opposite directions. And opinion. still sitting there, inert, no ethical effect.
And this mechanism, this devalorization, it leads to what the source calls a major social problem, depersonalization.
Mm-hmm. The counter-truth works almost like a spell. It encourages people, pushes them to identify completely with a role, a character, often the main character in whatever narrative the counter-truth is spinning.
Wait, identifying with a character, isn't that natural? We do it all the time with books, movies, heroes. Why is that depersonalizing?
Because, according to this view, that identification happens at the expense of your own unique developing personal dimension.
Okay, I need an example.
The source uses Achilles, classic hero, right?
Yeah.
The main character of the Iliad chooses glory and a short life over a long, peaceful one.
Yeah, very heroic.
But look at the cost. In serving that heroic story, he causes unbelievable suffering for his own side. He becomes isolated, bitter. He sacrifices his own potential for ethical growth, his dimension personnel, to fit the narrative mold.
So when we identify too strongly with a character in a powerful story, we risk giving up our own ethical journey to just play a part, maybe even a destructive part.
That's the danger. We serve the story, not ourselves. And this reframes that feeling of malaise that mal-être, the source, talks about in modern Western societies.
Right. Objectively, things are better in many ways, health, wealth, safety. But there's still this widespread anxiety, this feeling that something's wrong.
The source argues this isn't just random unhappiness. It's evidence of the spread of counter-truths, a general societal devalorization, a shrinking or tightening of the personal dimension for many people.
Like we're turning into those stone statues looking at Medusa, losing our individuality.
It fosters a society built on these rigid roles, these characters. And this isn't just politics. It applies strongly to literature, to mass media narratives, too.
How so? Fictions often feel like they expand our horizons.
They can, if interpreted philosophically. But the source warns that simply consuming stories, especially ones built around counter-truths that grab you emotionally, can actually trap you. They incite identification, making you turn away from your own personal dimension.
Especially if the stories we consume mostly come from one perspective. Like the source says, the victors, men, the powerful, the rich.
Right. Even if the content seems diverse, if the underlying viewpoint, say, a masculine, conquering, pillaging viewpoint remains the same, you're just reinforcing that identification, repeating that pattern.
The Odyssey example again, reading it over and over.
Locks you into that specific worldview. Ulysses, Penelope, Telemachus, they're all part of this hymn to, well, pillage and a certain kind of devalorization, according to this reading.
So how do you escape being trapped by a powerful story like that?
Through interpretation. You have to actively pull out the underlying invention. What's the philosophical truth hidden within the narrative? What's the single unique gesture that connects all the characters, that the story reveals, maybe unintentionally.
Until you do that analytical work, that philosophical invention.
You're just identifying. You're captive to the character, repeating the role.
Mm.
It's the act of interpretation that frees your personal dimension, neutralizes the counter-truth's grip.
Okay, let's ground this further. How does this philosophical structure play out in the real world? We see counter-truths used as weapons all the time, especially in politics.
Definitely. The source gives a really insightful reading of Orwell's 1984. It's not just a warning. It's analyzed as a perfect illustration of the counter-truth mechanism at work.
How so?
Think about the party's actions. Arbitrarily changing facts. 2 + 2 = 5. Systematically destroying language with newspeak. It's all designed for one purpose.
To strip people of their individuality.
Exactly. To reduce them to simple social functions, mere masks. To eliminate the dimension personnel.
And the characters like Winston Smith, who try to resist, try to hold on to some personal truth.
They end up fulfilling the party's narrative anyway, like Oedipus trying to escape his fate. Their struggle against the system is what ultimately traps them within it. The book's chilling power comes from how it shows the individual being crushed by this overwhelming ideological counter-truth.
Moving to maybe an even more challenging area, religious counter-truths. The source makes some pretty strong claims here.
Extremely strong. It explicitly defines the belief in immortality as a primary example of a powerful counter-truth.
Why? Because it ignores the true-false question.
Yes. It turns its back on that fundamental opposition and instead just generates noise, a diversion from the reality of our finite existence.
Wow. Okay, if we follow that logic, immortality as a counter-truth, how does that change our understanding of what's spiritual or good?
It flips everything. Remember, valorization, the growth of the personal dimension, is tied to our temporality. Birth, growth, death, that finite arc gives life meaning and urgency.
So trying to escape that temporality
is embracing a counter-truth. It condemns both yourself and the world to devalorization. Because if time doesn't matter, if there are infinite chances, then nothing have ultimate value now.
The source even says if immortality were real, it would be the absolute evil, because it would mean total devalorization.
That's the claim. So in this view, the spiritual dimension isn't about escaping death. It's about embracing the consciousness of mortality.
Having a soul means knowing you're mortal.
Synonymous with it, the source suggests that awareness is what drives the invention, the ethical striving, the expansion of the personal dimension.
What about reincarnation? That seems related.
It's treated with nuance. As an ideology used to control people, you suffer now because you deserved it in a past life, so accept your role. It's seen as a very dangerous counter-truth, justifying subjugation.
But philosophically,
it can be interpreted differently. As a metaphor for the different stages or lives we live within one lifetime, learning to accept the person you become, letting go of the characters you played before, that act of interpretation can pull a truth out of the potentially harmful narrative.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. Counter-truths creeping into science. How does that work?
It happens when scientific language gets loaded with ideology. The source points to examples in biology.
Like saying organisms are programmed to reproduce, or talking about a vegetal strategy.
Exactly. That's not objective description. It's imposing a model. It pushes this counter-truth that living things, including us, are just like quasi-computers running genetic code.
And the danger there is.
If you start with that premise, you stop focusing on the complex reality of the living organism itself. You only talk about the program, the inheritance. It prevents deeper understanding and reinforces a reductive, depersonalizing view of life. We're more than just our programming.
Finally, maybe the most pervasive one today, the narrative of decline. This feeling that everything is constantly getting worse.
Yeah, the constant drumbeat about rising crime, collapsing society, increasing misery.
The source identifies this as a major, powerful counter-truth currently dominating public discourse.
And it persists even when historical data clearly shows otherwise. The example given is 18th century France.
Right, where maybe 10% of the population lived in absolute destitution, facing starvation, massive violence, disease. Conditions far harsher than most people experience in the West today.
Objectively, things are much tougher. Rampant hunger, unpunished crimes, wars, incredibly high mortality. Yet we easily fall into this narrative that now is the worst time.
Why does that counter-truth stick so easily?
The source blames, in large part, the sheer speed and reach of modern communication. It's just so easy now to launch and spread these kinds of emotionally resonant, often absurd counter-truths. They catch fire online, create collective movements, and overwhelm fact-based analysis almost instantly.
So the speed amplifies the power of the counter-truth, making the philosophical task of resisting it even more urgent.
Okay, so we've laid out how powerful these counter-truths are. They're not just errors you can correct with a fact. They operate on a different level, actively devaluing things.
So how do you fight back? If facts and opinions are ineffective, what's the philosophical defense?
The answer, according to the source, is interpretation. You can't just argue against the counter-truth on its own terms.
We have to find the cracks.
Exactly. Look for the inconsistencies, the gaps in the narrative, the places where the interaction between the characters in the counter-truth doesn't quite make sense, and in those gaps.
You try to find traces of the personal dimension, the real human element struggling underneath the imposed narrative.
Precisely. The philosopher's job isn't to destroy the counter-truth directly, but to extract elements of genuine personal life from within it. By doing that, you neutralize its power to depersonalize. You perform a kind of conversion.
Ah, the conversion idea. A true formulation leads to a positive conversion.
Right. It expands and develops the personal dimension. It valorizes its growth.
Whereas the counter-truth forces a negative conversion.
Yeah.
Degrading, depersonalizing, trapping you in that character mask.
Exactly. An opinion. Still no effect on this ethical transformation.
This leads to that final, really beautiful analogy for how truth works, the chorus of thoughts. It's not about one genius finding the single right answer.
No, not at all. Thinking, true philosophical thinking, is more like a choir improvising together.
Each singer has their own voice, their own melody line. Maybe that's like their opinion or perspective.
Mm-hmm. But no single voice holds the key to the final harmony. The magic happens when they sing together. The result is something new, unpredictable, something none of them could have created alone.
And the truth isn't the final musical score they write down afterwards.
No. The truth is the transformative experience of singing together. It's the expansion of the personal dimension that happens in that moment for the participants. that feeling of resonance, of growth, of shared creation.
That's the truth, the ethical transformation itself.
That's the measure of the philosophical act. You don't necessarily abandon your own voice, your opinion, but you recognize its value isn't in isolation. It's in contributing to that unpredictable, shared, transformative process.
Which means philosophy is fundamentally this ongoing struggle against any system, any narrative, that tries to shut down that process, that tries to impose a fixed character or a final answer.
Yes. It fights all forms of counter-truth because they try to abolish that vital true-false distinction and lead to that loss of value, that depersonalization.
So philosophy isn't about building monuments, creating fixed works that might just become new counter-truths later.
Its job is more subtle, to shine an indirect interpretive light on all the existing works, all the narratives, all the ideologies.
To cut through the fog, dispel the mists of identification, as the source puts it.
Exactly. To free people from being trapped in those characters and allow for that continuous dynamic process of personalization to happen.
Right. We have definitely covered a lot of ground. We've drawn lines between opinion justified, maybe, but ethically static.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophical truth. This active, inventive process that valorizes and expands our personal dimension.
And the counter-truth, the real danger, actively devaluing, depersonalizing, trapping us in roles.
And in our world today, with digital media constantly feeding us personalized narratives at lightning speed,
the power and reach of the counter-truth just seems to be accelerating. It's harder than ever to resist identifying with the characters we're presented with, or the ones we create for ourselves online.
So if the deepest philosophical work, the path to developing your own dimension personnel, involves this constant struggle against identifying with a fixed character, against settling into comfortable opinions,
then the challenge for you listening right now is pretty direct.
Think about it. What's the single strongest opinion you hold? The belief that feels most luminous, most clarifying to you? The one you'd fight for?
And then? What's the opposing view? What's the foreign procedure, the radically different perspective that you instinctively resist or dismiss?
Maybe that's where your real philosophical journey needs to begin, engaging with that, intentionally studying it, not to necessarily adopt it, but to challenge yourself, to spark that invention, to expand your own personal dimension. That's the work.